From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the American political system is in bad shape. Seems like that's no grand revelation, not when you think about the partisan confrontations and the decline of genuine deliberation. It's bad, but really, is it any worse than any other time in history? It's a question the scholars Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann say they asked themselves constantly as they were writing their latest book, which explores the dysfunction in the system. Was all of this any different from the past? Their conclusion, they say, is firm. Yes, it's different. In fact, here's the title of their book. It's even worse than it looks. Ornstein and Mann are in Utah this week, and today in the program they're joining us. This is more than just restating the problem. They want to get at the source of this dysfunction and explain what it will take to change it. We'll be back after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholars Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann know better than most that something is wrong with America's political system. For decades, they've observed and written about the process. They've documented the demise of order and collegiality, the emergence of extreme partisanship, what they see as the weakening of checks and balances. And others have noticed it too, of course. You hear about this dysfunction all the time in the media. But in their latest book, Ornstein and Mann say they've been struck by the failure of the media to capture the real reason for it, the drivers of all these developments. And that's what they're trying to do in their book, which is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks. They explore the roots to the problems, but also suggest what it will take to change the system. Today in the program, Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein are joining us, and we invite you to join the conversation, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Thomas Mann is a senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. It's a public policy organization in Washington, D.C. And welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. It's a Washington-based research organization. And Norman Ornstein, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Doug.
We should mention that they're both the co-directors of the AEI Brookings Election Reform Project. They've co-authored a number of books together, including The Broken Branch, and they're in Utah as guests of the University of Utah's Marriott Library and the Hinckley Institute of Politics. They're speaking tomorrow on campus, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. I wanted to start, though, with I mentioned before that you've been writing about these problems for a long time, observing them. In the book The Broken Branch, which I referenced, and you wrote some 6 years ago, you describe your perspective then as sympathetic in the book. You say that you kind of it reflected your appreciation of the messiness that just comes along with all of this. But now it seems your perspective has changed, not so sympathetic, not so willing to just say, oh, this is just the messiness. Things have really changed in your perspective, I guess.
Doug, they really have. I mean, we certainly remain defenders of the Constitution. We appreciate that Congress is the first branch of government. We don't underestimate the constraints of governing in this very difficult period, but things have materially changed, and we felt we had to speak out, even if at the risk of seeming to come down on one side rather than the other. We now have a political party and a set of incentives driving that party to really wish for the failure of the other when it is governing, even at the cost of hurting the country itself. That is to say, the clearest route to a return to power in the White House and in the Congress is to make whoever is now in charge an abysmal failure. So what that does is brush aside the whole problem-solving nature of the Congress and the party system and set up a kind of tribal permanent war that absolutely prevents us from dealing in a timely way with a set of problems that the recent economic crisis and financial crisis have made even more daunting.
Norman Ornstein, I wonder if you too, did you sort of battle with yourselves, because you say you were asking yourselves this question constantly, whether in fact it is any worse now than it has been. This seems to be something that you hear that all the time, you know, oh, it was so much better back in the day. But you've really come to the conclusion that in some ways it was, that it is, as Thomas Mann said, quantitatively, decidedly different now.
Yeah, and of course we battled with it. You know, part of it is we're scholars, and so our natural inclination is to look at historical parallels.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, many political scientists disagree with us and say, oh, look at all the other times, it's really no different. There's some truth to that. It's kind of funny, Doug. About a year ago, I wrote a piece in Foreign Policy, which they titled Worst Period Congress Period Ever Period.
Right.
And I got a lot of pushback. Well, what about the period right before the Civil War? And my answer is, well, of course, you're right. Do you really want to be compared to the period right before the Civil War? And there are other parallels as well. But, of course, the other thing we battle against is, if you recall, Dana Carvey had this character when he was on Saturday Night Live, an old man who said, you know, in my day it was so much better.
Yeah. And it's a Monty Python sketch,
yeah,
too, right?
And, you know, we're cranky old men. It's true. But we've been around Washington for 43-plus years, and there's a natural tendency to look with rose-colored glasses at earlier times. We don't do that much. We understand. We lived through the impeachment of Richard Nixon, the impeachment of Bill Clinton, the schisms over the Vietnam War. There were plenty of difficult times. But we came firmly to the conclusion that this is different. And, you know, you mentioned the broken branch, where we talk about the messiness in the system. The framers built in messiness and rancor. And we gave it's a deliberate title. It's even worse than it looks, because it never looks good.
Right.
It's not people sitting around in the proverbial campfire holding hands and singing Kumbaya. It's never that. But bad as it looks, what Tom said, the decline of a focus on problem solving, which is not ideological. Bob Bennett was a problem solver. When we purge the problem solvers, and we live in a time where we have big problems, short and long term, then you get an urgency, and this book reflects that urgency.
We should just note that the reference to Bob Bennett, he was a former Utah senator who lost in a primary election to what most would consider much, much more stridently conservative candidate. There are a lot of stories and examples that illustrate really the dysfunction in the system. There's one story of one particular vote in the U.S. Senate that you use to kind of get things going in the book that seems to really characterize the problem. And it's a story that comes from January 26th, 2010. And it's a vote to create the Deficit Reduction Task Force. It's this effort to get at the country's debt problem. Talk about that moment, if you would, and let's talk about why that was such a significant moment for you.
This was a bill that was co-sponsored by a Republican and Democrat, Judd Gregg, the Republican. It had many Republican co-sponsors and supporters, even if they weren't co-sponsors. Mitch McConnell was a strong supporter and said this is exactly what needs to be done, creating this new commission that would then have access to the Senate on a fast-track basis, so couldn't be filibustered to death. Well, it turns out Barack Obama then proceeded to endorse the idea, at which point seven Republican co-sponsors plus McConnell, the leader of the Republican Party, not only withdrew their support, but lent their support to a filibuster of the measure so that it didn't even get a clean up or down vote in the Senate. Why? What had changed? What had happened? One thing. Obama was for it. And the whole strategy they set for themselves once he was elected president was to act as a parliamentary opposition party, to oppose anything and everything he was for, even when he embraced policies that they supported. They would suddenly not support them. So it was a war that had nothing to do with ideological difference. In this case, it was purely a political calculation.
You also write about the debt limit crisis from last year, which I think helps explain the kind of the condition of the political system. And you make a few references. He actually comes up three times in your book, Congressman Jason Chaffetz. He's the Republican representative from Utah's 3rd District, as kind of expressing the sentiment of the Republicans in the House at the time. Chaffetz said that leaders would have taken the country's credit down if their demands weren't made. He told the Washington Post, "We weren't kidding around. We would have taken it down." Norman Ornstein, talk about why that is so significant and really troubling.
You know, what happened with the debt limit, we have a new book by Bob Woodward, which goes into mind-numbing detail on all of this.
Yeah.
But we think gets it a little bit wrong. What's clear here is there was a conscious effort that began before the 2010 elections, led by the so-called young guns, who were the co-authors of a book. That's Paul Ryan, now, of course, the Republican vice presidential nominee, Kevin McCarthy, now the majority leader, or the majority whip, I should say, and Eric Cantor, the majority leader, knowing the debt limit was coming up, to use it as a hostage-taking device. It's never happened before. We've had games played with the debt limit, which comes up periodically. It's kind of a stupid thing to do because it's not as if you're actually increasing the debt. You're paying for past debts. You always see partisans, and that includes Barack Obama when he was in the Senate.
Right.
When it's the president of the other party, you vote against it so you can show your for fiscal responsibility. But everybody knew it was a game and you weren't going to actually threaten the full faith and credit of the United States. This, as Jason Chaffetz said, was different. Using this as a hostage mechanism put the country's economy in jeopardy. We saw the impact of it when the credit was, in fact, downgraded afterwards, even though they reached an 11th-hour agreement. Of course, that agreement now is under great siege because it's what's leading to these mindless sequesters. But what you had for the first time was a group of people who wanted not only to play this game of chicken, but to send it right over the cliff if their non-negotiable demands weren't met. Jason Chaffetz among them. And if we had, in fact, breached the debt limit, there is a good chance now we would be in something close to a depression. We came out of it, but with enormous damage. And once again, it's a sign that we're not into an era where people will play partisan games. That's built into the process. Yeah. But understand there's a larger responsibility here. I make one other point, which is that John Boehner, when he knew he was going to become speaker right after the 2010 elections, first thing he did was to lecture his partisans, including the freshmen coming in and the other firebrands like Chaffetz. And he said, you know, we're going to be in the majority now. We bear a share of the responsibility for governing. That means we're going to have to swallow hard and do some things we would prefer not to. And right at the top of the list, he said, was increasing the debt limit to meet the United States obligations and sacred obligations. Then we went through this debacle. And it'll tell you where we are now, that we're leading into another. There will be another debt limit coming up, perhaps in January, could be earlier, probably a little bit later. And now it's John Boehner saying, we're going to take the hostage again. And you play these kinds of games, and all it does is to damage the country's fundamental economy. But now Boehner is basically a leader who understands where his troops are going, and he's trying to run a little bit faster to get in front of them. We're no longer in a situation where they say, hold on here, we can't do that. And that's dangerous, dangerous in the extreme.
One of the things that you really do in the book is you go back and explore, as I mentioned, kind of the roots to all of this. You talk about you make sort of a passing reference to the 1960s, which I don't necessarily want to get into, but I found interesting. We could probably do a whole show about that influence, but I want to go to 1970.
Well, such a good time.
Such a good time. There are a number of developments that really one of the turning points comes in 1978 that you write about, and I want to get into this because you talk about this enterprise that you had started at the time called the Congress Project. And you say that the culture and the rules of Congress were evolving, and you were trying to sort of get at it. And you had this series of off-the-record meetings with people. Among them, Dick Cheney was one. Geraldine Ferraro was one. And one was Newt Gingrich. Talk about that series of meetings, if you would, and this new figure, really, I guess, in 1978, Newt Gingrich.
Doug, it was a fascinating experience, series of off-the-record but taped interviews with seven new members of the House of Representatives. Dick Cheney was a part of it, as you said, Geraldine Ferraro. But Newt emerged as the dominant figure because Newt came to the House with a plan, a plan to put the Republicans in the majority, a noble plan. Democrats had a long-term, almost permanent majority in the House that went on 16 additional years, hit 40 years. They thought it was a birthright to be in the majority. So it was a good thing that he had this plan. But the plan was to so delegitimize the Congress as an institution that the public would become so appalled with it that they would throw out the people in charge and give the Republicans an opportunity to govern. But in the course of it, they broke down the norms of comity and civility. They attacked their opponents viciously and accused them of corruption with little argumentation, probably did more to diminish the Congress as an institution and set up the idea of friends and enemies, of good guys and bad guys. It was all black and white, and it set the stage for the partisan blocks and the intense tribal partisanship that really came to do great damage to our politics.
Well, it's interesting because you write about the fact that Gingrich wasn't always this ideologically rigid, that he could be pretty pragmatic and he could be – what happened?
Well,
he came up with a strategy?
Oh, yeah. He was a Rockefeller Republican, but he saw with Ronald Reagan's election and then the Prop 13 – anti-tax move in California 2 years before that the politics were shifting to the right. And so he adapted. But if you look at Newt over the years, you will find him saying some very embarrassing things to Republicans, attacking Paul Ryan's budget, sort of supporting efforts to deal with global warming, wanted to make huge investments in health, information technology, a range of things. So Newt is not a diehard conservative ideologue. He is a political and partisan strategist who was building a political machine to take down the opposition and the Congress with it, not to advance an ideological agenda.
You talk about over time how Newt Gingrich managed to kind of radicalize even moderate Republicans. And you say spring of 1994 was kind of the seminal moment of the strategy. This is the C-SPAN, so-called C-SPAN controversy. Do you want to talk about that?
Because it's sure. Moment. And I must say, Newt had some unwitting allies in Democrats who, you know, Tom said, felt they had a God-given right to be in the majority. You know, a party that has been in the majority for 25 or 30 consecutive years becomes arrogant and condescending and with some corruption involved. But Newt understood that he could use this to prod them and get them to overreact. And one of the things that he did, and he was a bit of a visionary, once we got television coming to Congress with C-SPAN, even though the audiences were not huge, he knew that you could create a different dynamic and world out there. And Congress has for years had this, the House, period in the evening when they're not doing any official business, but it's open to members to come and talk about whatever they want.
And no one's practically there.
No one comes, right? Just the person who's
right.
Doing it.
Yeah.
But he also knew that they'd set up C-SPAN so that the cameras were fixed on the speaker.
Yeah.
And you had no idea that the chamber was empty. And Newt orchestrated it so that he'd get two or three or four of his members coming in, and they would have a colloquy where they would make just radical and dramatic charges against Democrats, that they were aiding and abetting the enemy in Nicaragua, that they were fomenting socialism at home. And they would go back and forth. And the implication was that Democrats were sitting there mute, not responding because it was all true and they had nothing to say. And finally, it just infuriated Speaker Tip O'Neill enough that he went onto the floor, which a speaker rarely did, and said about some of these charges that they were unpatriotic, that it was the lowest thing he'd seen in all of his years as speaker. And you're not supposed to do that. His words were taken down, which is a big embarrassment. But what it did.
Now, this is what Gingrich wanted, right?
Exactly what Gingrich wanted. It was the greatest moment of his life. And because it, you know, among other things, it legitimized him as a figure. He had been a gadfly. And the Republican leadership, problem solvers at that time, led by Bob Michael, who's still around in his 90s and just a wonderful human being and was a great patriot and member of Congress, was appalled by all of this. But all of a sudden, Newt was on a par with the speaker. And it was the speaker who was being chastised for it. And all of that worked. But in the process of making it work, it denigrated the House as an institution. It fomented the tribalism. And we continue to have the reverberations from that. I should add, Newt didn't want to have that be a permanent reaction. He wanted it to lead to a Republican majority, he would become speaker, and then he'd turn around and say—
And then people would just put aside the fact
now
that
it's all fine, we're in charge, and this is the best institution, and we ought to be the leaders. Part of the problem is he recruited people in 90, 92, 94, gave them the words. Frank Luntz came up with the right words that inflame people.
I've got them here. Betray, bizarre, decay, anti-flag, anti-family, pathetic, radical—
All those neutral words.
Right.
But he created a generation of people who believed all of that, even though he didn't. And let me just give you one anecdote that tells you where all of this led, because many of those people who came in the early 90s into the House moved to the Senate. So here's a story that Alan Simpson told me. And it is—
Wyoming senator.
Senator and former senator. Rick Santorum, who is now well known, of course, as one of the presidential candidates, moved to the Senate from the House, serving in the Senate. And a few years back, Simpson paid a visit to his old institution, the Senate, walked onto the floor with Rick Santorum. And when he got onto the floor, he saw on the other side of the aisle, the Democratic side, Dale Bumpers, a longtime Democratic senator from Arkansas. And he went over and they embraced and had a warm conversation. And Simpson says he looked over and Santorum, pretty agitated, was motioning him back. And after a few minutes, he walked back and said, yeah, well, what's the problem? And Santorum said, what was that all about? And Simpson said, that's Dale Bumpers. He's my blood brother. We came in together. We worked on a lot of things. He's one of the finest people I know. And Santorum said, we don't do things like that around here anymore. And, you know, I said to Simpson, was that because you were embracing a guy or because you were embracing a Democrat? And he said, probably a little bit of both.
Sounds like Simpson.
But it was a sense that the Senate had now been infected with the same tribalism, even though it's only 100 people and they all know each other. And we've seen that play out, and it plays out a lot in the story that Tom told about the commission, the Greg Conrad Commission.
You know, early in the book, you say that the public's disgust with Congress in Washington is actually part of the problem, not the basis for a solution. So what you're saying is that Newt Gingrich was trying to create this sense of disgust by tearing down, you know, the sense of decorum in Congress. I mean, that was the strategy. He wanted people to be disgusted.
That's right, because when the public's disgusted, what they tend to do is say, throw the bums out. Let's get rid of those in charge. Let's replace them with other people. And
which happened in 94, I guess, right?
It worked like a charm, right?
It worked like a charm. It also worked like a charm in 2010. You know, you demonize what's being done. You try to keep the program from being enacted, and then you attack the team in charge for not getting the results that America likes. But we tend to be a throw the bums out public mentality, oftentimes then replacing them with candidates who promise not to be politicians, who promise not to compromise, to stand on their principles, that is replacing them with a group of people who don't share the objectives that the framers had in mind for the Congress to come together, albeit with different values and representing different interests, to deliberate. So we don't have the right people, and we reward teams that do their best to make government fail and the team in power to fail. So our argument really is, the public needs to be more nuanced and strategic and get a sense of how this is working, what the political dynamic inside Washington is that's producing the results that they find appalling, because without that understanding, they're in no position to fix it.
Before we head into a break, I wanted to ask you this. It seems like for a couple of decades now then, three probably, really the Democrats have been played pretty well by the Republicans. They've outplayed this strategy in terms of using the techniques, the right words. Are they figuring it out yet, Democrats?
Democrats, I think, are becoming somewhat more aggressive in this. One of the things that happened is Obama came in and really believed his 2004 speech that, we're
Purple
not a red America and a blue America. We're the United States of America, and we need to transcend the partisanship. And tried that for 2.5 years. And I think actually it was the debt limit debacle that radicalized him a little bit. He then began to ratchet up the pressure a bit, and we actually saw an agreement. The agreement was on the payroll tax cut to try and keep the economy moving a little bit. Democrats have become somewhat more aggressive. What I hope doesn't happen is that over time, if it turns out that the only thing that works in our electoral politics is you hope for a bad economy when the other guy is in charge, you unite together to delegitimize everything they do, and that brings you an electoral reward. And there is a danger in this that Democrats will start to throw out their problem solvers and bring in a more radical left-wing element, and that we get a much further polarization. What we point out, and not just our opinion, but we've got, there's a lot of data that scholars and others have come up with. The parties have separated, like parliamentary parties, but it's the Republican Party that's moved dramatically more to the right. The Democrats have moved, but only modestly so. You know, if you use the familiar old football field analogy, Democrats have moved to about the 35-yard line. The Republicans are behind their own goalposts now, and the replacement of Bob Bennett with Mike Lee is a pretty good demonstration of that. If Democrats start to move towards their goalposts, God help us.
Well, you mentioned a couple of those indicators. You say that 70% of Republicans in the electorate identify themselves as conservative or very conservative. Well, 40% of Democrats say they're liberal or very liberal. And there's another one that I wanted you to mention. It's hard to sort of talk about a graph on the radio, but there's this voting averages graph that's really telling, I think. I wanted you to say something about that. Republicans, you say, have moved really much more sharply in the conservative directions, as you said, than Democrats have moved in the liberal. Thomas Mann, can you give us a sense of what that graph looks like? Because it's really striking.
Yes, it's really quite amazing. It's the sort of Poole-Rosenthal measures of voting and tracing party and ideology over time. And it goes back to the post-Civil War period. So we can trace this well over 100 years. And what we see is that we had a deeply polarized period in the late 1890s, the early part of the 20th century, big divisions between the parties. But then they came together more. There was a lot of cross-party coalitions, and there really was a center in both the House and the Senate. But then, beginning really in starting in the 1970s and then picking up in intensity, and then in the last decade and the last couple of years, the movement of the Republicans sort of goes almost off the page in one direction, while Democrats sort of change, but it was mainly because the conservative Southern Democrats left the party. But all of the other non-Southern Democrats stayed roughly where they were before. And it's also reflected in presidential agendas and platforms. There's so many measures of the way in which the two parties have come to differentiate themselves. And in some respects now, it's not appropriate to say we have a conservative party and a liberal party. What we have is a center-left party, and we have a radical party, which is in no way fits the old meaning of conservative. Conservative was to be careful and slow and preserve and protect. We have a party now that's much more an insurgency against 100 years of policy development.
An outlier.
In America, very much an outlier.
I want to read something you write in the book. You say it's traditional that those in American media intent on showing their lack of bias frequently report to their viewers and their readers that both sides are equally guilty of partisan misbehavior. You say journalistic traditions notwithstanding, reality is very different. And this is one of the problems, you say, with the media is it's tried to sort of see this as being equal when, in fact, even though it's difficult to do if you're in the media because it seems like you're partisan, it's just not.
Let me put this in the form of an anecdote. I actually wrote a little piece in the New Republic chastising some Washington Post reporters who had written a story. You may recall Eric Cantor, the majority leader, decided to change common practice back at the time when we had the hurricanes and the earthquake in the Northeast. And federal government has always provided disaster relief, and it's done in a supplemental fashion. Now, before that, we'd had terrible storms in the Midwest. And Cantor said, we're not going to let this happen anymore. If you want disaster relief for the Northeast, it's got to be offset, not by taxes, but by cuts in other programs. And that can mean you pay for the Northeast disasters by taking money from the Midwest disasters, or you pay for it by taking from food stamps or other programs. And that was a dramatic change. And Democrats said, no, we're not going to make that change. And the Post wrote a story that said Democrats picked a fight. And so I wrote a piece that said, well, that's like saying, imagine you're a reporter and your publisher comes to you and says, we want you to slant a story to benefit an advertiser. And you said, no, we're not going to do that. And the story that emerged was reporters picked a fight. That's not what happened here. And we got a sanctimonious email from another Washington Post reporter, a veteran, saying, you guys are completely wrong. Our job is to report both sides of the story. And I wrote back and said, your job is to report the truth. That's like saying there's a hit and run incident and you report as an equal event, the hit-and-run driver saying, hey, it's his fault, he stepped into the crosswalk, as if it's got equal moral weight with the victim. That's not reality here, and your job is not to say reflexively that there's equality on both sides. It is to sort it out when there isn't, and there's enormous resistance, especially by editors and publishers, to doing that because they are so sensitive to charges of bias that they've inculcated a value that we believe is wrongheaded.
Norm Nornstein is with us, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thomas Mann is here, senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Their book is called, we should say, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. They're here as guests of the University of Utah's Marriott Library and Hinckley Institute of Politics. Tomorrow afternoon at 12:15, they're going to be giving a lecture at the library's Gould Auditorium. For more information on that, visit our website, radiowest.kuer.org. I am very late for a break, so we're going to go do one now. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the scholars Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann are with us to explain just what's wrong with the American political system. Most everyone realizes the process isn't working very well. There's a decline in deliberation and cooperation, an extreme sense of partisanship. But the question is why, and not only that, just what do you do about it? Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein are in Utah here to give a lecture. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. Their book that we're talking about today is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Our telephone number, 801-585-WEST, is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to the phones. Thad is with us in Salt Lake. Thad, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call, and I want to welcome Tom and Norm to Salt Lake City. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. tomorrow and miss your talk. I wanted to bring up 2 points. One is to understand the graph that they're mentioning about voting behavior. Mickey Edwards, who helped found the Heritage Foundation, his last year of Congress was before the Republican takeover. He would now be the sixth most liberal member of the House of Representatives. So that tells you how far the party has moved. The question I want to ask them, though, is this, is how do you view governance in Congress right now? Congress is not reauthorizing programs. They're not doing any sort of oversight. So what does this mean for our ability to address fundamental problems like making decisions about what programs should be cut or how programs should be restructured to make them more efficient and things like that? Can Congress do anything in that regard?
Thad, thank you for calling. Sure. We're sorry you'll miss the lecture. The answer is it's even worse than it was when we wrote The Broken Branch. If you are going to cut government and cut the size and scope of it, you should do it intelligently, not with a meat axe. And whether that meat axe is a sequester or an across-the-board cut of any sort, it's not doing what you should do, which is what Congress used to do at least much better. And that is use the authorization and appropriations processes to look at agencies and programs and say what's working and what's not working. How can we make them work if they're functions that we want to pursue? And as you say, they've lost that ability completely. You know, part of the problem now is the nightmare when you have parliamentary parties in a non-parliamentary system is when you get divided government and a parliamentary minority. So we have the mother of all do-nothing Congresses right now. And the ability to use the oversight capacity, what we see is Daryl Issa, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, using it more for gotcha investigations. The appropriations process is broken down completely. It used to be the place where you had real bipartisan oversight done. And instead, we get program cuts that are going to cut into public safety, cut into homeland security, cut into vital things like health research. And it's really shameful. But that's partly what happens when you denigrate the institution and people who come in don't care about the institution. They're using it as a vehicle for radical change.
So it's interesting, though, because how you do that, and some of the things that you talk about, and I wanted to sort of have you briefly address this, is you've got to get at the ideological gulf between the parties. I mean, that's one of the things you say you've got to really address. You've got to increase internal homogeneity. You've got to deal with the prevalence of constituencies that are safe for one party or the other. You talk about the influence of news organizations and outside groups that are reinforcing this ideological purity. Fox News, I'm guessing, MSNBC, those kinds of things. How? You know, I know this, we'll talk about some of the governmental structural reforms that you want to get at, but how do you deal with that, which seems like such an abstract problem?
Well, Doug, there is no silver bullet. There's no easy way of doing this, but we believe one of the ways is to increase the size of the electorate. Right now, we have voting participation of about 60% in general elections, 40% in midterm elections. And then when you get to off-year elections and primary elections, which can be absolutely critical, you're down to 20%, 15%, 10%. It turns out the smaller the electorate, the more it tends to represent the bases of the two parties, the more efforts go into mobilizing the base and therefore playing to the extremes, and the less other voices of problem solving, not necessarily well-defined ideological centrism. That's not what we're after. It's really a problem solving orientation. How do we get this done? So we have a whole host of recommendations. Some dramatic, like mandatory attendance at the polls.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that one. You may as well talk about that. I mean, you're saying is make it mandatory, make it so it's a law. You have to vote.
It's really seems so over the top in America, where freedom is everything, and you know the jokes about if I vote, it'll only encourage them. But in fact, many democracies and well-functioning democracies have this provision of mandatory attendance at the polls, not mandatory voting. You can come, take an empty ballot, and cast an empty ballot. You can pay a $20 fine. You can write a letter saying, my kid was sick or I had to travel for a business reason. No problem. Fine, exempted. But if the expectation is there, it's then wired into the whole society and the educational system, and people come to realize they have a role as citizens. And then it changes campaign strategies and in many countries tends to move the political debate sort of more to the center than to the extremes.
Let me mention one other point here, Doug. You know, problem solving, as Tom said, is not ideological. And Mickey Edwards, who was the chairman of the American Conservative Union, Thad mentioned him and is a great American, and his book is a wonderful book as well, was a problem solver, and he believed in his institution in Congress. We are leeching out the problem solvers who happen to be politicians. It's a dirty word now. The framers were politicians. Voters are a part of the problem here because there is a natural tendency when you're feeling that the system is broken to throw out the politicians and anybody who stands up and says, I'm not like the rest of them and I've got the answers. Never mind that shades of gray stuff. It's black and white. Those people have traction in this process. We found it appalling that somebody like a Herman Cain would stand up and say, I don't speak politician, and would suddenly get this enormous wave of support. Put him into an environment where you've got to govern, and it's an absolute disaster. We don't need those kinds of people. We need people who know what they're doing and have respect for their institutions and respect for the Constitution, which the framers wanted people in an extended republic who would work with others, talk to others, put themselves in their shoes, and then find a way to solve problems based on a common set of facts and an understanding that you've got to reach those compromises. It's what Bill Clinton actually talked about so eloquently in his speech at the Democratic Convention.
You also want to change Election Day. You're not crazy about the Tuesday, I guess.
No, and you know, I was a founder of an organization called whytuesday.org. Most people have no idea why the elections are held on Tuesday, and that includes most of our major elected officials. But the fact is, if we moved Election Day to the weekend, and if we had our druthers, it would be a 24-hour period from noon Saturday to noon Sunday. No Sabbath problems. You want to respect those. Have early voting on a few days before for people who can't do it on the weekends. So many people are constrained by a work day. The only time they can vote is before they go to work or after they get home. Those are the peak hours, long lines. It's not a good way to run things. And the fact that we set Election Day on Tuesday in 1845 because of Market Day, it took a day to get there, a day to get back. You wanted to have the Sabbath free. Those are not reasons that apply in 21st century America.
Norman Ornstein is with us, and Thomas Mann. They are in Utah as guests of the University of Utah's Marriott Library and Hinckley Institute of Politics. Tomorrow afternoon at 12:15, they're going to be giving a lecture at the library's Gould Auditorium. For more information, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Their book is called It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein. We're talking about their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. They're here in Utah, guests of the University of Utah's Marriott Library and the Hinckley Institute of Politics. They're giving a lecture tomorrow. We'll give you the details about that here at the end of the program. I want to go through a few more things. These are some of the things that I think may disappoint some people. Because these are the things that you suggested, the strategies and even bromides that you don't think will work. Among them, a third party. You say that's just not going to solve the problem. Say something about that.
We wrote about this while Americans Elect was raising money and qualifying to get another candidate on the ballot. We said they have misdiagnosed the problem. They imagine the parties are equally polarized and have alienated the great center of the American public. And therefore, if we create an opportunity for an independent candidate, maybe bipartisan, that will somehow lead us out of our woes. In fact, it was a disaster. They found no such candidate and folded their tent. That's not a way to make any progress, and much more productive avenues exist.
Term limits, you're not for?
No, and we understand the sentiment. You want to get away from a destructive ambition where people are manipulated and all they want to do is satisfy the electorate in the short term. The problem that we found is, and we now have a lot of experience with term limits in a lot of places and a lot of studies of them, what happens is it has the opposite effect. It channels ambition in exactly the wrong direction. A place like California, you get term limits. People come into one office and they immediately start looking for how they get to the next office or for how they can feather their nests after they leave. And the answer is short-term solutions with a big splash, and you leave the problems behind for the next guy, and you turn the locus of power over to the permanent people who are the lobbyists and the staff. You have no institutional memory. So it would be nice, but it doesn't work.
A balanced budget amendment. You say that's one of the remedies that you hear from time to time, but you say it's a faulty response.
It would almost certainly do more harm than good. One of the reasons a nation has a government and steers an economy is to deal with unanticipated and difficult financial crises, economic crises. The budget should not be balanced all the time. And if we had restrictions built in, say supermajority requirements to act in some way to increase spending to try to deal with this, we would take a middling recession and turn it into a depression. The bottom line is we had a balanced budget not too long ago. It was 1998, 99, 2000, and 2001. We can do it. We know what has to be done. And politicians always look to avoid making the tough substantive decisions and look for a gimmick.
We talked about some of the things you think will work. Voter reform, for example, expanding the vote. Talk about some of the things you write about in terms of reforming the political institutions. One in particular is really interesting, limiting the filibuster to one per bill.
Yeah, there are many parts of the filibuster that also tell us that the problem is not just the rules, it's the culture. The filibuster rule has been the same since 1975. It didn't cause gridlock or terrible problems in the political process until the last 3 or 4 years, when the culture changed so that the rule was misused in a way that had never happened before. And it was used purely as a weapon of destruction, of obstruction. And it has been on routine matters, including things that ultimately got unanimous support. Now you can have a filibuster on the motion to proceed to take up a bill, a filibuster on the bill itself, another filibuster on a conference report if the House and Senate come back with a compromise. And each one takes an enormous amount of time to overcome. So at minimum, you should limit filibusters to one bite of the apple, one per bill. But we also believe you've got to go further than that. We don't want to abolish the filibuster entirely. There's some value in having a minority that feels intensely about something important having a role to play. And the filibuster can also, in a good way, move to force a bipartisan response. But the onus should be on the minority to be able to produce the 40 votes over time to keep debate going instead of coming to a resolution. Now it's on the majority to produce those 60 votes, and that's wrong. And so you can tilt this process so that it remains as a constructive element from time to time, but not the destructive obstructionist one that we've had now.
I want to get to another way you say you can change things, and that is to change the political culture. The most compelling, I think, of that is, do you say restore public shame?
Don't you think it's time for leaders in society to speak out when we hear just outrageous statements? I mean, one that comes to mind that we report in the book is a hedge fund private equity executive being so offended that Obama might consider a proposal in which the so-called carried interest, the income earned by in private equity, not from work, somehow be treated to a 15% tax rate instead of normal tax rates. So Obama said we ought to go back to the way it was, and this gentleman said that's like the Nazis invading Poland. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's said regularly. Where are our societal leaders in the business community and educational institutions, religious organizations? People need to sort of speak up. We ought to shame such behavior.
And lies. You know, lies now, you double down on them if you get caught in a lie. There's no shame involved. That is simply, you know, outrageous, over-the-top statements and flat-out lies need to be held accountable.
Well, we're out of time. I should mention there are a lot of other ideas in the book, restoring, recreating a public square, creating a shadow Congress. In the end, I should mention, even though I don't have time to ask you about it, you are optimistic, despite the title of the book. It's even worse than it looks, how the American constitutional system collided with the new politics of extremism. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Doug.
Go to our website. They're going to be speaking on the University of Utah campus tomorrow at 12:15. Radio West, production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.